I have a full lesson for you today. The lesson today is a simple concept, but it can be easily overlooked and often is. And the flurry of activity in the world all around us at times can easily overshadow this biblical principle that I'm going to be getting at this morning. But when you stop and realize this simple truth, it will change your entire outlook and attitude and will absolutely encourage and strengthen you spiritually. All right, we'll be live streaming to Sermon Audio and YouTube. And also, if you enjoy these Bible studies, share them with your friends and family. I air these Bible studies every Friday on 8 o'clock a.m. and 8 o'clock p.m. Pacific time on Final Fight Bible Radio. And all of my recorded video material is also available archived on sermonaudio.com. And if you're interested in additional in-depth studies, I have now 4 books that have been published and are available on the Final Fight Bible Radio bookstore, the newest one being The Time of the End 2, which I'm very excited about, The Time of the End 2, The Seven Heads of the Dragon, and The Nation Beasts of the Last Days. And if you thought my first book with the 10-year tribulation theory was interesting, this book will blow your mind. All right, so you can pre-order your copy of that if you want, if you're interested in that type of thing, and hopefully that'll be a blessing as well. All right, so we are in John chapter 10, and I'm going to go and read the passage just so we can get back on track with where we're at. It says, "Verily, verily," John chapter 10, verse 1, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, he that entereth not by the door into the sheepfold, but climbeth up some other way, the same is a thief and a robber. But he that entereth in by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. To him the porter openeth, and the sheep hear his voice, and he calleth his own sheep by name, and leadeth them out. And when he putteth forth his own sheep, he goeth before them, and the sheep follow him, for they know his voice. And a stranger will they not follow, but will flee from him, for they know not the voice of strangers. This parable spake Jesus unto them, but they understood not what things they were which he spake unto them. Then said Jesus unto them again, Verily, verily, I say unto you, I am the door of the sheep. All that ever came before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not hear them. I am the door. By me, if any man enter in, he shall be saved, and shall go in and out and find pasture. The thief cometh not but for to steal, and to kill, and to destroy. I am come that they might have life, and that they might have it more abundantly. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd giveth his life for the sheep. But he that is an hireling, and not the shepherd, whose own the sheep are not, seeth the wolf coming, and leaveth the sheep, and fleeth. And the wolf catcheth them, and scattereth the sheep. The hireling fleeth, because he is an hireling, and careth not for the sheep. I am the good shepherd, and know my sheep, and am known of mine. And as the Father knoweth me, even so know I the Father, and I lay down my life for the sheep." All right, so I taught a lot on that passage last week, got into the details of that and the identities of these different people, but I really want to get into this week something that the Lord gave me through my Bible reading a number of weeks ago that I wrote down in my Bible journal, like I've encouraged you to do if you watch the series on tips on reading and studying your Bible. This was one of the things that the Lord showed me in my Bible reading, and I just wrote it down, and now I'd like to develop it into a lesson. And so last week was kind of to set the stage for this week. And as we saw, the shepherd is the Jesus Christ. He is the shepherd. He is the owner of the sheep. And the thief is also the wolf and is the stranger in the passage. And we looked last week at what the wolf can represent biblically. And then the hireling, I mentioned last week and explained that the hireling is also a shepherd. It's not like the hireling is a blacksmith who is hired just to temporarily watch these sheep, or the hireling is some kind of baker or something like that. No, the hireling is a shepherd. He's not the shepherd, but he is a shepherd and is simply an overseer of the sheep and not the owner of the sheep. Jesus Christ is the chief shepherd, according to 1 Peter 5:4, and he owns the sheep. Jesus bought them with his own blood. And the Lord's ministers, such as apostles, prophets, pastors, teachers, they are shepherds too, biblically, 1 Peter chapter 5, but they would fall under the category of a hireling shepherd. Because there is one shepherd, the shepherd, one owner. All the rest, all the other shepherds, are hireling shepherds whose own the sheep are not. The sheep belong to the shepherd, not a shepherd, okay? The hireling is just watching the sheep that belong to the shepherd, all right? The shepherd is higher in authority than the hireling shepherd, and the sheep belong
to the shepherd, not the hireling. All right?
That is very important, and that will serve to help you very much in your Christian walk if you get a hold of that. All right? So there's no difference between a shepherd and hireling, because the hireling is a shepherd who is hired by the owner of the sheep to watch over and feed the sheep while the owner is away. And so all ministers are hirelings who have been called by Jesus Christ to do a specific job, and at the end of the task, they will be rewarded for a job well done. That's the definition of a hireling, someone who's been hired to do a task and will be paid, rewarded when the job is done. That fits the definition, the description of a minister. All right, you've been hired, called by Jesus Christ to do a job, and you'll be rewarded when you're done. That makes you a hireling. All right. So, all ministers are hirelings, and they'll be rewarded for a job well done. The hireling shepherd does not own the sheep that he's been put over. The sheep are not owned by their hireling shepherd. The hireling should feed and gather and heal and help help the sheep, and should never scatter sheep. And when a hireling begins to scatter sheep, he's acting more like a wolf at that time. As a matter of fact, consider this. In this story, John chapter 10, why is the chief shepherd leaving and having to hire a substitute shepherd in the first place? Turn to Luke chapter 15. You ever think about that? Here this good shepherd is leaving the sheep. Why is he doing that? Is he going on vacation or something? What's the deal? Why is the good shepherd leaving the sheep in the care of a hireling in the first place? Well, I think we can infer from Luke chapter 15 what a possible reason for that might be. Look at Luke chapter 15 and verse 3. And he spake this parable unto them, saying, what man of you, having 100 sheep, if he lose one of them, doth not leave the 99 in the wilderness and go after that which is lost until he find it? You see, the good shepherd doesn't believe in collateral damage. The good shepherd doesn't believe that it's okay to lose one as long as you have the 99. As far as the good shepherd's concerned, he's going to do everything in his power to make sure that not one single sheep is scattered out of his flock. That's a good shepherd right there. And an hireling can learn a lot from a shepherd like that. But he goes to find a sheep that's lost, all right? The sheep wandered off for whatever reason, and so the good shepherd goes and tries to find it. But think about this. Leaving 99 of your sheep alone in the wilderness admittedly doesn't seem to be a very good idea. Let's just be honest. Jesus here in the passage, let's just face it, he is appealing to common sense. He's appealing to common sense. Look at what he said there in 15 verse 4. He says, what man of you having 100 sheep? You know, he's saying, all of you know, this is what all of you would do. What man of you? In other words, he's appealing to the common sense of everybody around him. They can all relate with what he's saying. They can all understand, yeah, I do that too. You know, he's saying, what man of you? He's not pointing out any kind of exceptional thing. He's appealing to common sense here. But is it common sense? Think about this. Let's just think a little bit, which is what I try to encourage you to do in these Bible studies. Think. Is it common sense to leave 99 sheep alone by themselves in the middle of nowhere while you go to find one sheep? Would not the other 99 sheep be missing or scattered or just all over the place when you came back? Common sense would indicate that's probably what would happen. I mean, one sheep wandered off under your care and supervision, you know, which happens. You know, these sheep are grazing and this one sheep can wander off. That happens. But if the shepherd leaves, is he going to come back and find all 99 sheep, you know, just sitting patiently waiting for his return? No, there'd be more of them scattered. There'd be a wolf that would come in and eaten a bunch of them. So what does the owner have to do when he goes to find the one missing sheep? He hires an hireling to watch his sheep while he's gone. You see that? You see how those two passages kind of fit together? What man of you would leave 99 sheep by themselves? You know, in other words, it's common sense that you would hire an hireling to keep care and watch and oversee your sheep while you're gone. All right, so the hireling seems to be implied in Luke 15 because that matches common sense and it seems to fit the concept there in John chapter 10. All right, so maybe the chief shepherd, like I said, is not just going on a vacation. Maybe that's not why he left. Maybe one of his sheep ran off and he decided to go after it. but for the sake of the safety of the other sheep, he left them in the care of a substitute shepherd or an hireling. All right? Now, in the parable of Luke 15 that we just looked at, the shepherd, let's say, finds his sheep, you know, and he lays it on his shoulder like he does in the passage, and he returns rejoicing. But how ticked off do you think that shepherd will be if he comes back and finds that his own hireling scattered a whole bunch of his sheep for questioning the hireling's authority? Right? I don't think the shepherd's going to be too happy if his hireling just started kicking and beating down all his sheep for questioning his authority. But it happens a lot. How ticked off do you think the good shepherd would be if his hireling is nowhere to be found because he ran away from a wolf and now the shepherd's got a bunch of dead sheep all around, right? You know, the other thing about a hireling scattering sheep and kicking sheep, if the good shepherd comes back and he finds only 97 of his 99 sheep because the hireling got upset because a couple of sheep questioned his authority, right? You know what the good shepherd's going to do? He's probably going to fire that hireling, get a different hireling, but then he's going to go out and try to find those other two sheep. He's not going to say, okay, hireling, you're right. They shouldn't have questioned your authority. Let them go. Let them be devoured. What kind of crazy world do you think? What are you thinking with this stuff? All right? That's not how the good shepherd is. All right? But that's how a lot of hirelings are. So anyway, in both scenarios, if the hireling is scattering the sheep or if the hireling leaves his post and lets the wolf come and devour the sheep and doesn't do his job. In both scenarios, the hireling is not properly doing the job that he's been called to do. And however, as I pointed last week, a hireling is not predestined to fail either. The hireling could turn out to be lousy, as he does in the particular illustration that Jesus gives in John chapter 10, but the hireling could just as easily fulfill his task too. And when the shepherd returns, the hireling could hear, "Well done, thou good and faithful servant," and be rewarded for a job well done, all right? So the hireling is not predestined to fail. Now, no hirelings, just remember this too, no hirelings are perfect, but not all hirelings are bad, and not all hirelings are good. Some start out good, but then turn out bad, and some start out not that good, but get better over time. Let's just face it, the hirelings are human, all right? They're not God. But by the way, if you're not a shepherd, if you're not a spiritual shepherd, feeding spiritual sheep, then be content to simply feed on the word of God. Nothing wrong with that. And try to be a blessing to any hireling shepherd who is helping you and feeding you. All right? Now, today I hope to encourage those of you that are in some form of ministry. And this can apply to Sunday school teachers, youth group leaders, Christian school teachers, you know, pastors, missionaries, anyone like that. Anyone who's been tasked by the Lord to minister the word of God to Christians. I hope this lesson will be a blessing to you. And you are like that hireling shepherd. I don't know if that hurts your ego much, but this is what I am like. This is what you are like. If you are called to minister the word of God, you are like that hireling shepherd. You have been given a calling, you've been given a job, and Jesus Christ expects you to not quit. Okay? Not quit. Sometimes your location may change. Sometimes your particular venue might change. But if Jesus Christ has tasked you with feeding sheep, then feed them wherever you find them, all right? Bear in mind that Jesus has sheep everywhere, and quitting is not ministering over here and then going to a different location and ministering over there. I know sometimes the brethren consider that quitting. Oh, he left his post. No, your calling is your post. And if you're ministering to sheep here, and then you're ministering to sheep over here, you haven't left your post. You're still performing the calling that God has given you. It's just that sometimes your location can change, and that's fine. Quitting is abandoning the chief shepherd and his sheep altogether and just saying, phooey on it, I'm done, and leaving the whole thing behind, and leaving the chief shepherd. All right, that's quitting. So don't quit. It will be worth it. There is a great reward at the end. But let's face it, there are some times that are tough. And sometimes it's sunshine with a nice light breeze. And sometimes it's freezing rain in the darkness, okay? And all of that should be anticipated and ought to be expected if you're an hireling. But none of that is a reason to quit. And you can stop when the chief shepherd returns. But until then, don't stop. Who cares how big or small the flock you are tasked with is? Don't quit. Who cares what other hirelings are doing? Don't stop. Who cares what if brother hireling over there disapproves of your methods of shepherding? You don't answer to brother hireling. You answer to the chief shepherd. So don't stop. Keep going. But sometimes hirelings do stop. Sometimes hirelings do quit and they do fail. And sometimes it's because of the environment and difficult circumstances that get them to quit. And sometimes it's the fear of the wolf. The wolf starts to show his ugly face and it causes the hireling to flee. And sometimes that's why hirelings quit. But sometimes it's a much, much simpler thing that causes hirelings to quit. Sometimes it's the perception of uselessness that causes hirelings to walk away. The perception of uselessness. Sometimes hirelings don't see a lot of results, and especially these days, and don't see a lot of progress, and so they start to think, well, I'm not making a difference, so what does it matter if I stay or go? It doesn't matter. I'm not making a difference anyway. So why am I standing here? Why am I doing this? I'm not making a difference. You ever have those thoughts? You know, I'm not making a difference. I'm not effective. I hear of what other hirelings are doing, and they're doing way more than I'm doing. You know, you say, you see that hireling over there? His flock is just getting bigger and bigger every single week. You see that hireling over there? He's got dead wolves laying all around him. That hireling is awesome. But here I am with nothing going on. I don't have anything going on. And maybe right now the flock you have is just your family. Maybe the flock you have is just a little Sunday school class. Or maybe it's a little church crammed into a tiny rental space or a living room. Or maybe it's just a handful of people that tune in every week. You know, nothing wrong with that. Or maybe it's just a combination of those things. Regardless, your position is such that Jesus has given you a task of feeding and ministering to others. But even that little bit of action of feeding people and ministering and the little bit of action that you get with people is not usually all the time. You know, the sheep graze and you help one out here and there. But you know what a lot of the hireling's job consists of? The hireling's job mostly consists of standing. Just standing. A vast percentage of his time is spent just standing, and that's it. You think about that. I mean, honestly, think about that. A hireling, a shepherd, what does he spend most of his time doing? Usually it's just standing. There's a little bit of action here and there. Sometimes the wolf comes and there's a little bit of some adrenaline, you know. Sometimes the sheep has a problem or breaks its leg or, you know, something like this or that, and you have to feed the sheep and do that. But a lot of time it's just standing, not very exciting, kind of boring. And there's a tendency to think that by standing, you're not doing anything. You're not accomplishing anything. Or you're just wasting time. And sometimes it does feel that way. All I'm doing is standing here. What difference am I making? And, you know, you're not growing the flock necessarily by standing. You're not necessarily killing wolves left and right by standing, right? And so you start to think that you're useless. But here's the thing. Jesus didn't necessarily call you to grow the numbers of his flock. That's not why you were hired. Jesus didn't hire you to kill the wolves. Sometimes those things can happen, but Jesus hired you to feed his sheep and to watch over them. Jesus hired you to stand there. That's what he wants you to do, because that's what he spends a lot of his time doing. He's just standing. He's been standing, amen? And he hired you to stand there, all right? And if you do that, you are doing exactly what you are supposed to. You are a success. You are not a failure. And believe it or not, you are making a big difference just by doing that, just by standing. You might not think you're making a difference, but you are. And I want to explain how you are making a difference by telling you about a pattern of behavior that's been observed in societies throughout history that illustrates the lesson that I'm trying to get across here in John chapter 10. Now, have you ever heard of mass formation psychosis or mass formation? It's a popular term that was in alternative media quite a bit about year or so ago during the pandemic, right? The planned thing. But anyway, it's a psychological term, mass formation psychosis. Now, not all of psychology is bad. Let me just insert this real quick. A lot of times Bible believers kind of start to convulse when they hear the word psychology. But not all of psychology is bad, just as not all of science is bad. Evolution and Darwinian science is obviously total garbage, just as Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung psychology is total garbage, okay? We get that. But science is just the observation of things in the natural world and trying to learn things from the natural world. And psychology, to a large extent, is simply just the observation of the human spirit and patterns of behavior that people engage in. And so you can learn some things through that. A lot of times, just as animals behave in a certain way a lot of times, so humans, not saying that humans are animals or evolved animals, but what I'm saying is God developed humans, and humans have certain patterns of behavior that can begin to be seen and recognized, and psychology simply observes those patterns and then tries to make reasoned explanations for those patterns and observations and things like that. Now, the book of Proverbs and the book of Ecclesiastes, in a lot of that material, in modern terms, would be labeled psychology, because a lot of it has to do with the spirit of man, the mind, the heart, and how people act and react to different circumstances. Okay, so just because I use the word psychology doesn't mean that I'm putting science and psychology above the word of God or anything like that. Okay, so don't freak out. All right, it's just a word that explain that this mass formation. I spelled formation wrong. Formation. Oh, dumb. Formation. Mass formation. Just caught that. Is a term that relates to psychology, but it's a observable pattern of human behavior that has taken place over and over and over and over throughout history. And so we can stand to learn something by it, because what we're going to find is this pattern of behavior in society is mirrored in some of the things that we see in this spiritual lesson of John chapter 10. So I think you might find this interesting and encouraging, because I know I did. All right. So, mass formation psychosis is a psychological term that refers to an observed, repetitive pattern of behavior of the masses that always precedes the takeover of a totalitarian regime. All right, I'll say that again. Mass formation psychosis is an observed, repetitive pattern of human behavior, particularly of the masses of people, that always precedes the takeover of a totalitarian regime. Now, if you're awake in the modern world, you can see why this might be something that would be of interest to you, because this precedes the takeover of a totalitarian regime. All right? So let's see how many things of this match our modern society. All right? Totalitarianism is the end stage of mass formation. Okay? And elements of this pattern have been noticed by multiple historians and psychologists for a long time. But recently, a psychologist by the name of Matthias Desmet, he's a person from the Netherlands, Matthias Desmet, he coined this term, mass formation, and he really analyzed and encapsulated this entire process from beginning to end, totalitarianism, in his book, The Psychology of Totalitarianism. And if you're interested in this type of thing, I've included the link at the bottom of this video. You can find the book on Amazon. All right, and there's also a link to a video interview that he did. It's about an hour long that basically encapsulates the entire thing. So if you're a type of person that doesn't have time to read 300 pages, you can watch this hour-long clip and basically get the whole idea boiled down. And it's very informative, I will say that. But the reason why Matthias Desmet and his theory became so popular recently is because everything about the pattern that he described that happens in societies throughout history was being repeated during the lockdowns up to this present time. And if you've ever wondered what is going on with people these days, why are people all of a sudden acting so crazy? Why is the world so vastly different than it was 10 years ago? I mean, you just think about how people were 10 years ago and how they are today. It's like people are hypnotized or something. It's like they're crazy. And if you've ever wondered why or how is this happening or what caused this to happen, this historical repeating pattern of history really does a good job in explaining how we got here and where it's going. And I don't pretend to understand all of it. There's still a lot of information that I'm still trying to wrap my head around, but there are some primary points that he mentions that leads to that a society that's a normal functioning society begins to lead to a mass formation, and then that leads to totalitarianism. So he says in the early stages that it begins with a pop. Now, like I said, this is Matthias Desmet's theory. All right, I'm not preaching his theory, but it seems like he nailed it. It's not his own theory that he invented. He's just simply observing this historical pattern, and he's boiled it down into a handful of points. And I think he's right. But anyway, he says that in society, it starts with disconnection, and isolation. This is kind of the root problem that leads to the takeover of totalitarianism. When a society, when a people are, obviously sin is the root problem, I get that. But when a society of people are disconnected from each other and start to become isolated from one another, they don't have personal relationships with people in the outside world. And human beings, God created human beings to have personal relationships. I mean, he created Adam, and in the same day, later that evening, he created Eve so that he could have that relationship. Because why? God said it's not good for the man to be alone. All right, that goes for marriage, you know, if you will, but that also goes for just people in general. It's not good for human beings to be alone. God created us for relationships and to have relationships and bonds with one another. And disconnection from other people and isolation from other people has a negative impact on your psyche, your spirit, your soul, your heart, your mind, your person, all right? So because people don't have relationships with people in the outside world, but instead are stuck in their homes, in modern times, you know, maybe what they have is shallow, illusory, artificial online relationships that replace actual in-person relationships, right? And so what happens, you know, these online social chat groups and all that stuff, you know, they have their place, but don't let those things replace in-person relationships. It's fine to watch, you know, YouTube videos and online church services, but do what you can to try to find other believers to meet together with in person, right? A church to go to and be around other Christians in person. Don't let the online stuff replace the real thing, okay? Because what you're doing is you're indulging in an artificial thing that has its usefulness, but don't let it replace the real thing or there's going to be problems in your life. And so a lack of genuine relationships over time causes a lack of meaning, or purpose in life. Because a lot of life has to do with relationships. God built us that way. God created us that way. And so if you don't have those personal relationships and you become completely isolated, like a lot of people were during lockdown, right? There was a purpose for all that. What happens is people begin to develop a lack of meaning because they don't have those relationships. They begin to develop a lack of purpose in life. And people gain a sense of value through their relationships because they feel valued by others, or they perceive the value that they are extending to other people in these personal relationships. But isolation takes those relationships away, which in turn takes their value and sense of purpose in life away, and it creates this sense of drifting through life with no direction and no purpose. And what that does is it creates what he calls when you have no purpose in life, no meaning to life, which a lot of Americans, a lot of people in this world have. They say, what is the point in my life? I just get up, I, you know, maybe work online, you know, and then after work, I play video games online. I have none of these interpersonal connections, and they start to have no purpose in life, and it creates a free-floating anxiety. It creates a free-floating anxiety, frustration,
The anxiety turns to frustration, and the frustration turns to aggression eventually. All right?
Fear leads to the frustration, leads to the aggression. And it's free-floating. It's free-floating anxiety in the sense that there's no actual tangible threat to their existence, right? It's not like there's a guy with a knife trying to stab them. It's not like that. It's free-floating. They have this anxiety that they can't really pinpoint where it's coming from. There's no actual tangible enemy that is directly attacking them. Nevertheless, people begin to feel anxious and fearful, because they don't know where the feeling is coming from. You know, they're just sitting in their homes, watching the news, starting to feel all this anxiety and don't know what's going on. You know, they don't know where the feeling is coming from. They don't know why they're feeling anxious. They don't know how to fix it. And so their anxiety becomes frustration. And the pent-up feelings of frustration start crossing into attitudes and feelings of aggression. All right? Now, like I said, this pertains to society. And I'll explain how this pertains to our lesson in a moment. But this pertains to society, and this can be observed throughout history. It can be observed in Germany leading up to World War II. It can be observed in France and some of the other places that he goes through our history and describes. But the thing is, the people that are aware of this, there are some people that are evil and are aware of this, and you could call them social engineers, if you will. Social engineers who understand this know that when a decent percentage of the population starts to get at this stage, they can be easily manipulated and even exhibit all the behaviors of someone who is hypnotized. Except we're talking about a mass of people. They can start exhibiting the behavior of someone who's hypnotized. A mass population of people literally begin to act like a hypnotized person, right? And so all the social engineers have to do at this stage, the next stage, is provide an enemy for the people, for a target. Basically, they just need to provide an enemy for these hypnotized people to target. All right? If everyone identifies the enemy as the same thing, let's say everyone in the news media says that the enemy is CUFID or Russia, or the enemy is global warming or patriots, you know, or Trump supporters. Maybe they're the enemy. Whoever the loudest voice identifies the enemy as being, the hypnotized people will believe the authoritative voice, and they become relieved because the frustrated people finally understand who is causing their anxiety and how to fix the problem. And you fix the problem by eliminating the enemy that you've been provided. Now, of course, this is the wrong enemy, and it's the wrong solution being presented by the wrong voices, but because of the state of mind that people have been brought into, they can't recognize their error. They won't recognize their error because they don't want to go back to the anxiety of not knowing what the problem is. You say, why is society acting so crazy? Why are people around me acting so crazy? Why are these things happening that are going on? It's because people are acting hypnotized, and they're being manipulated by a voice. They're being deliberately manipulated, and those people, you say, it's so obvious. How could they not see that Drag Queen Story Hour is bad for society? How could they not see that? How could they not see all these things? It's because they've been provided an enemy, and they don't want the common sense, because if they reject the enemy that's being presented to them, then they go back to the free-floating anxiety, because the unsaved world, they don't know what's going on. They don't know who the enemy is. And so they just have this, they go back to the isolation, the lack of meaning, the free-floating anxiety. So they want to have this enemy because it gives them a sense of purpose in life. Let's attack Trump supporters. It gives me a sense of purpose in life. Basically, that's how it works. An invented problem is perfectly acceptable so long as it makes people feel good. You know, the virtue signaling. You know, so long as it makes people feel assured. So long as it gives them a new sense of purpose. We need to fight the enemy. And this whole type of thing was played out in the BLM and Antifa riots back in 2020. The enemy that was presented to the people at that time was fascism. Except fascism was just a bad-sounding label that was slapped on anybody that didn't go along with the news media's narrative, right? So whatever the narrative was, if you went against it or contradicted it, well, you're a fascist. And we have to fight fascists. Fascists are the enemy. And so people would start attacking their neighbors and attacking their family, disconnecting family members. You know, all this crazy stuff was happening in society, and society was getting ripped apart and divided, and it still is to this day, right? And so the enemy at that time was fascism, even though 99 out of 100 of those people that were rioting couldn't define fascism if their life depended on it. But the enemy was fascism, you know, so they had, so whatever, whoever got that label of fascism slapped on them, these people now have a sense of purpose in life. Destroy the fascists or destroy the Nazis. Punch a Nazi in the face. You know, that was in the news media, except the people that got the term, the label Nazi slapped on them were people who voted, you know, conservative. You're a Nazi, so now we got to fight you. You see that? You know, if you're against the injections, let's say, you know, so now you don't believe in science. You know, you're against society. You don't believe in the health of society. So now you're an enemy that these hypnotized people are told to target. You know, if you don't believe in global warming, you know, you're some kind of ignoramus that's destroying the world. You're destroying the world. You're the reason for all of our problems. So now you have to be attacked. You become the enemy. You become labeled for simply having common sense. And hypnotized people come and start attacking those people. Why? Because it gives them a sense of purpose and meaning in life. I am a hero for fighting the enemy. You see that? And the whole time they're being completely manipulated by a puppeteer. Now, this psychologist, Matthias Desmet, has noticed throughout history that it only takes 30% of the population to be in this state of mind for a totalitarian regime to take over. Because usually what happens, you say only 30% of a society in totalitarianism can take over? Unfortunately, yes. Because usually the other 60% of society, even if they don't agree with the crazy hypnotized people, we have a lot of that today. We have a lot of crazy hypnotized people today. And there's a lot of people that still have common sense that don't agree with this, right? But the thing is, this 60%, the majority of people are too scared or too apathetic to say anything or stand against the psychotic 30%. You know, they just want to live their lives and do their thing and, you know, just whatever. I just want to go, you know, work my job, take care of my family. I just want to stay out of it. All right? Well, they're not going to do anything. So that enables the 30% to essentially have, that makes essentially 90% of society goes along with the interests of the totalitarian regime that's manipulating the 30%. These 30% are being completely manipulated by social engineers, and 60% doesn't stand against them, doesn't do anything. They just stand aside, or they just kind of virtue signal and kind of pretend like, yeah, I'm on your side, yeah, racist, let's get them. You know, but so the 30% can start to take over, and that's all that's necessary for totalitarianism to take over historically throughout societies, right around the 30% of the society. And so you ask, well, what about the 10% that do stand up or do speak out? Well, it's these people are of critical importance, and these people, the 10% that do stand up and do speak out, make all the difference during this stage of mass formation. Because once you reach the end of the mass formation, once the mass formation gets to the point where you're 30% and upwards, it's pretty much game over. So while this is happening, these 10% of people, while this 30% is growing and growing, these 10% of people are of critical, critical importance. And citing examples from history, he shows time and time again that when the small, outspoken minority continues to speak out, their resistance prevents the mass formation from solidifying, which in turn prevents the totalitarians from being able to take over. Because they're speaking out of truth continually, what does it do? It disrupts the hypnotic spell that's being cast over the people. If there's no voices to disrupt the spell, then this 30% starts to grow very, very quickly, and you get to the point where it can't, there's the point of no return, And basically, the totalitarians can then take over. So the totalitarians, you know, they realize that they need to silence the 10%. They need to ban those people. They need to imprison those people. They need to destroy those people somehow. Because the 10% are the ones that are preventing their victory. And he also noted, Matthias Desmond also noted, that in every instance when that small percentage of outspoken people cease to speak up, whether it's because of fear, intimidation, or just they're not popular with other people, you know, they get made fun of or whatever, so they just say, you know what, I'm just not going to speak up anymore. When they cease to speak up, it's usually only a matter of a few months before the totalitarians gain control and the real atrocities begin. And he shows this whole process, how that happened in Poland, specifically right before World War II and Hitler took over. Now you say, well, what does all that have to do with John chapter 10? Well, like I said, the truth that's in John chapter 10 is actually simply something that Matthias Desmet observed in society. But we already had all of this in John chapter 10. Now here's what's kind of interesting. The tiny outspoken minority, you need to understand this. This is what really matters. The tiny outspoken minority does not win by destroying the totalitarians. Nor do they win by getting the brainwashed masses on their side. That's not how you win. They don't win by getting the 30% to basically go to their side. As a matter of fact, it's been observed that it's virtually impossible to change the minds of the crazy hypnotized people that are in this 30% category. And if you're watching, you probably know who I'm referring to when I say the crazy hypnotized 30% of the people in society. You know who I'm referring to. Those people, it's virtually impossible to change their mind. So it's almost like don't even waste your time, you know, trying to help them to see common sense. You just need to keep speaking out. Obviously, you know, the most important thing is to preach the gospel, you know, try to win those people to Christ, but it's been observed in society as a repeating pattern that these people pretty much never change. It's almost like they're too far gone. They're almost like a reprobate mind type of thing. All right. So anyway, the victory of the 10% that speak out, their victory is not in defeating the enemy or in gaining the multitudes. You need to get those ideas out of your mind. If you're thinking, what can I do? What can I do? I've got to defeat the enemy. I've got to gain people on my side. That's what I'll do. That's not where your victory is. Their victory is in preventing totalitarianism from consolidating power. And all these people have to do to prevent that from happening is they have to continue to stand up and speak out, because as long as they do that, this will never get to the point where the totalitarians can take over. These people must continue to stand up. They must continue to speak out. And this is how you make a difference against the, you know, essentially the Marxists trying to take over your town, which they're trying to do, trying to take over your schools, which we know they're trying to do, trying to take over churches, right? There's a lot of insane wickedness that's just being bombarded on us at all times. You say, what can I do? I hate this stuff. I hate what they're doing to my children. I hate the influences that they're trying to push down my children's throats. What can I do? What you can do is stand up, speak out. Don't quit. That's what you do. Because as long as people keep doing that in our society and in your town, in your city where you live, as long as people keep standing up, keep speaking out, this mass formation cannot congeal to the point where the whole society gets taken over. Such a powerful enemy can be hindered from its ambitions simply by the diligence of a few to keep speaking up. And to use a crude illustration from Hollywood, which I truly hate doing, but it does illustrate my point perfectly. Just because you didn't blow up the Death Star doesn't mean that you failed. You are victorious even if all you did was prevent its beam from firing. All right? You are victorious. You see, here's where this applies to John chapter 10. The hireling's success is not in defeating all of the wolves or gaining all of the sheep. A lot of times that's what we think as Christians. It's in the action. What action am I doing? Am I killing wolves or am I gaining sheep? And we think that's where the victory lies. That is not where the victory lies. The hireling's success is in preventing the wolf from scattering the sheep. He doesn't need to kill the wolf. There will be no end to the wolves. Success is not in making wolves extinct. If eliminating all wolves and all threats is winning in your mind, then you will never, ever, ever be victorious, because there will always be wolves. There will always be evil men trying to take over. There will always be wickedness in this world. If your idea of victory is eliminating the wolves, you will never be victorious as a Christian. If winning in your mind is gaining all the sheep, then you will never be victorious, and you will constantly perceive yourself as a total failure, because you will never gain all the sheep. But that was never your job in the first place. And if your idea of victory and winning is killing the wolf, then you are always going to be a failure, because even if you kill this wolf, there will be another wolf to replace him. And if you think that victory is when all wolves are gone, then you will always perceive yourself as a total failure in the Christian life. You see, victory is in standing. Standing is victory. Are you standing? Then you are already victorious. You are already winning. And the opposite of standing, fleeing is failing. So therefore, standing is success. Standing is victory. The hireling's success is in preventing the wolf from scattering the sheep. It's not in killing the wolf, it's in preventing the wolf. Just like I explained here, the success of the 10% is preventing totalitarianism from taking over, not in destroying the totalitarians. Success is not in converting the crazy hypnotized 30%. No, the success of the 10% is an ongoing battle of simply preventing the Death Star from firing the beam. You see, that's how it works. It only takes one hireling shepherd to prevent a scattering of the flock. You were hired to watch the sheep and make sure this flock doesn't get scattered. And the way you do that is by standing, and you don't need an army. You just need a small minority of people who will stand. And you need to be among that minority. You need to stand. The hireling may never fight the wolf. He may never even see the wolf. But the wolf sees him, that's for sure. You can be sure that lurking in these trees is a wolf, even if you can't see him. But he sees you, and he's watching you. And the wolf is ready to come as soon as the hireling leaves. The wolf will kill and scatter the sheep as soon as the hireling leaves. But as long as the hireling stands, as long as the hireling is standing there, the sheep are safe from being scattered. And as long as the hireling shepherd is standing there, the owner shepherd is pleased. And all he did was stand. 95% of his time, all he did was the boring task of standing. Not super exciting, you know, not a lot of fireworks and action, but standing, and by doing so, he's victorious. So the title of this lesson was How Not Making a Difference Makes a Difference. Because just when you're standing, you're just doing what you're supposed to, sometimes you feel, I'm not making a difference. But you have no idea just how much of a difference you're making. Because by doing that, if you didn't do that, all these sheep would be dead and scattered and gone, and it'd be total disaster. But the boring task of just standing, you are making a difference. You don't think you're making a difference, but you are making a difference. And remember that next time you think that you're not making a difference. Just by standing and not giving up, you are making a far, far greater difference than you even realize. Whether that's spiritually in a church setting, or whether that's in your society,
just standing up for truth and righteousness, or standing up for the gospel, standing up for the Bible. Just by standing and speaking up, you're making a far, far greater difference than you even realize. So I hope this lesson was a blessing to you. I know that this type of concept was encouraging to me, because I'm one of those people that feels like, well, am I even making a difference? You know, I feel like there's not a whole lot of action going on. I'm just doing what Jesus told me to do. Don't feel like I see a lot of results. But when people, when the shepherd flees, when the hirelings flee, that's when you see just how big of a difference that man was making. You see? And same goes for you. So I hope this was a blessing. God bless you. Have a good week.